for almost 30 years, I feel like I've had this kind of like almost obsession about enlightenment. And so naturally that drew me into these communities supposedly based on that practice and realization, and traveling far to meet teachers and teachings to help with this, and I say it as almost like a kind of confession. Like sometimes I feel it almost like a little bit embarrassing, and sometimes when I talk to people, like it's as an obsession. I mean, like basically every day. With occasionally I might take like a day off or something, but I'm thinking about this, studying about this, trying to practice with this. My understanding about it is like way different, like 95% different than when I started, right? And but just that sometimes when I talk to people, I realize not everybody has the same obsession. And it's almost startling sometimes when, like, really? Especially some, like, around Zen centers, not even everybody necessarily has this obsession. Thank goodness. And then I think there's so many reasons that draw us to practice. I think also, like, many people come to practice from just really deep suffering. And I myself came from some suffering, but in a way I feel like I've had a kind of somewhat easy life, relatively speaking. Not exactly, maybe like the Buddha growing up in the palace without seeing any old age, sickness, and death, but kind of close in some ways. And so even in that environment, the Buddha felt, when he finally did see the reality of old age, sickness, and death, he couldn't barely stand it, right? I will die. There must be another way, right? And in fact, that was one way he spoke of his so-called enlightenment, was actually the end of birth and death, the deathless. So because of this obsession, maybe sometimes I overlook other issues, maybe more minor issues compared to enlightenment somehow in my mind, but that are important. But that's how obsessions can be. So I don't know what exactly I'm saying, just that sometimes maybe that might be a reason why I sometimes feel like out of accord, or I'm not fully meeting people. Or we might say that that everybody, all beings even, are on some level obsessed with so-called enlightenment. Enlightenment meaning just true, complete, reliable, unshakable, permanent freedom from every trace of suffering in a way that could be available to all beings. But so therefore, it's so, I can get so into this kind of ultimate goal in a way that the little problems along the way kind of like, let's kind of sweep them aside because actually they're not the main issue at hand. Does that make sense? Something like that. Maybe you sometimes can sense that in me, I don't know, where it's maybe a kind of area, it's a kind of, this obsession is something that maybe I don't even notice because I feel like, well, isn't everybody all around spending their whole day thinking about enlightenment? And sometimes I get these little glimpses of like, no, actually, I'm maybe a little bit of a, like a weirdo in that way.
My sense is that everybody I've read about it, like you read about it, of course we all read Yogananda at the beginning, you know, our trek, it seems like, but that's just the start of that kind of seeker.
Yeah, a kind of seeker in a way. And of course, I get distracted from that all the time. I don't want to paint the picture that I'm always on the ball, but I feel my distraction from it, and I'm questioning my distractions from it. Basically, I'm sometimes questioning anything other than this project, right? So, and that's, I think, why I'm often drawn to these kind of teachings. Like, Kazan seems to be like, constantly driving home the same point, and Dogen too, that there's not that many teachings that are just like, well, here's how you kind of work with this particular emotion or something, right? Which I think is so valuable, those kind of teachings, but the enlightenment obsession tends to actually say, well, then that's the particular emotions maybe aren't that crucial as long as we understand that they're completely empty. Right? This maybe often the direction that I tend to go with things. Whereas I think like maybe American Buddhism in general, I mean particularly American Zen and maybe Vipassana community, I think one of the great blendings is mixing this dharma with psychology and working with emotions. Not that that's not there in the Buddhist teachings, but in the Buddha's and the Zen ancestors' teachings, it's so tiny. In the Shakyamuni Buddha's teaching, Pali Canon is quite practical and has a little bit about working with emotions, but the classic Zen texts of Dogen and Kazan, in 1,000 pages, you might find nothing, you know, particularly about working with particular emotions, right? It's always pointing to the ultimate, the ultimate, the ultimate. Cutting through duality and delusion. Yes.
The idea behind that, like the other than them, is that they don't even want to accept the idea of itself. They don't want to even deal with psychology. They don't want to be on that.
Yeah, like that. Yeah, yeah. And you know, there's danger of like the modern term we have is like spiritual bypass, right? When you're actually like, which could be, you know, if we're too obsessed with enlightenment and we're totally ignoring the conventional workings of relationships and so on, then it's really gone too far. But I don't think that that Dogen and Kazan were spiritual bypassing. I mean, a modern psychologist might say that they are, actually. But I think that they're not neglecting these other issues, but they're just like constantly putting the ultimate in the forefront. And I think it's because the ultimate is so, not what we usually pay attention to that we almost like, we have to constantly keep remembering and hearing about pointing to it from different angles. And it's not intuitive, in other words. It won't just dawn on us naturally, I would say. So we have to put a lot of time and energy into very subtle types of teachings. And if our life is a big mess, for example, then I think that's when it's really a spiritual bypass, right? If our relationships are all falling apart, if everyone seems to hate us or something like this, then like, wait a second, maybe there's some other stuff to take care of. But and then maybe we all have our individual take on how much are we working on just taking care of the conventional stuff, and how much are we focused on the ultimate. And that sounds as if they're two completely different things, which of course they're not, right? But in some ways there also is this different emphasis. Yes.
I've mentioned this with you before, that sashin almost feels like cheating in a way, or like a shortcut or something, or it's, there's this sort of almost palpable thickness that seems to be so very difficult to keep track of in the conventional world. I feel like everything moves so fast. And
there's so many things we have to attend to.
It's very true.
Complicated things, yeah.
Yeah, and interacting more and more with screens and...
and people.
Yeah.
We talk and stuff like that.
Yeah, more and more, like, waves of, like, generation after generation. Folks, younger and younger, as I get older and older, I feel like things are just moving faster and faster.
Yes.
And so it's so helpful in a setting where you can, like, literally... be so slow, and I don't know if deliberate's the right word, but it makes me feel like there's a desire to create in the conventional world sort of a micro environment where it's like I can still do my thing and be who I am and, be about my conventional life, but in more of a slow, like molasses kind of way, and still keep up somehow, still pace with the rest of the world?
Yeah, maybe it's not even so much speed of slow or fast, but more like ways that we don't get sucked into the grip of the nitty-gritty, difficult conventionalities that most of the world hasn't even actually heard of the so-called ultimate, right? So it's not, of course, it's just the conventionals, and we're trying to make the best of the conventional. How can we find ways to do that? And sashin definitely is a different and unusual kind of environment. And, yes?
So we're kind of similar thing, where it's like, many of us, we came because we were suffering. And practice was, for me, was more about being in my body. It was like teaching me how to be in my body, to have contact, like kind of meet the uncomfortable things. And then Dogen was like way like supernatural to me. And I didn't understand what was going on. It was like magic,
Yeah.
And I had no way of grasping, really understanding it. That
was sort
of, had I not been affected by being in my body and having like, kind of a somatic feeling in Zazen when I first started and stuff like that, that kind of kept me coming back.
Kind
of like that feeling.
Yeah.
And then over time, it's taken me, quite some time to get to the point, the teachings of Dogen or Keizong or all these ancestors. It's, now I'm starting to like, oh, okay, that's, I kind of understand that a little bit.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But from a very earliest stage, that's just, that's PhD stuff,
I think that's right. I think Dogen and Keizon could be seen to be very, like, advanced teachings that are actually inappropriate to hear if you're just starting practice. And where everybody is on that gradation is hard to know.
Yeah.
Depends on the person.
Yeah, depends on the person.
And so that's part of this unique creature of American Zen, that my experience of Japanese Zen is that people who are, you know, sometimes people are a little bit new to practice when they show up at the Japanese monastery, but it kind of means when you show up at the Japanese monastery, I think there's a kind of understanding you're signing up for the Enlightenment Project, and so you, and you're putting aside your conventional life. It's a monastery, yeah. So it has that context, and then of course these so-called more advanced teachings naturally are brought up there, and they don't actually have this kind of thing that we have in America for people who are wanting to learn some meditation. They want to learn some stress reduction because life is so crazy these days and so busy. Maybe there's a few places in Japan that are now getting the idea from America to try that kind of thing, but the general take in my experience in Japan is Zen practice in general is for these monks who put everything aside to go do that, and lay people in Japan, and we'll say we have no idea what that Zen thing is about that people do over there, and it is kind of like a supernatural thing, and it's of all the Buddhist traditions, it's considered like the hardest and most like severe and esoteric and challenging and subtle. So sometimes, because I've had that background, right, in that as an Enlightenment obsessor, I was drawn over there, and of course I felt totally my element in that kind of setting. And Tassajara is a kind of a mixed bag, I think. I like to hang out with the other Enlightenment obsessors that are drawn to places like that, but other people aren't, actually. Yeah.
I guess being American, I can't understand how to understand, like, let's say, back going through human feelings. It's to me, like, we were talking about with the Japanese, it sounds materialistic. It's like, I want to be enlightened, I want to get something. And it's just, I'm being simplistic here, but it sounds like, I'm going to get a carrot, I'm going to be enlightened, and then I'm going to, end up suffering, and people are going to notice this, and I'm going to teach, and, I just don't see how you can just jump up there by just reading and sitting,
Yeah.
I don't know if that makes sense.
There is that way that you speak of. It's true, I think, in Japan and America, of like, it's something that you're going to get that's going to cure everything, and then you can take it easy after that, right? And if you practice hard enough, you can get it quick. I think maybe Rinzai Zen even more emphasizes, intentionally puts the carrot out there. But I think just the people I was practicing with in the monastery over there, both Japanese and Americans and Europeans, was again a mixed bag. There were these idealists and who just don't really know what it means anyway, but hear about it as some abstract thing and trying to get it. And then there's those who are have some understanding that it's this greed, hate, and delusion that's like fueling our suffering, and so some way to work with that and see through that in a more realistic way, but it's still going to take everything. And how in any culture it seems like we can't jump. If we do try to jump right to this some abstract thing, it'll just be our confused ideas about what it is anyway. And we have to work with, it is kind of a gradual path, even though we call it the Southern School. I think we might be hearing Southern teachings, but maybe we're getting them more and more, we're getting them gradually, more deeply. So, yes?
Well, thank goodness for Pema Chodron.
Yeah, yeah.
Not the Zen tradition, but she has so much compassion and so willing to be there with the suffering that everybody that she meets is going through.
Yeah, and
she's,
I think,
not afraid of it.
Not afraid, and I think the teachings are simple and accessible enough to that people can usually get them really quickly without maybe any practice background, that people can, they can be moved and changed and transformed by those teachings, wouldn't you say?
They're also very deep because she doesn't stop there. And, you know, they're continually coming back as we they're continually coming back, which would lead to the essence of the emptiness of all things. But I don't know, the culture, the Asian culture is so different from the American culture.
Yeah.
And I think that probably it's not that they don't feel that their emotions aren't as present or as strong, but I think they just don't pay that much attention.
I think that's right.
That
they don't pay so much attention to their emotions.
Yeah. Like the structure is stronger of their lives and the tradition, and that sort of is a substitute for dealing one-to-one with the emotions.
Yeah, yeah. And it's maybe a cultural thing, and these are of course very broad sweeping generalizations.
Mm-hmm.
So we're making here, but that is my experience in various Asian countries, practicing with people there, that it is a little bit more just like what you're saying, and for whatever reasons,
yeah.
Maybe it's because life is somewhat more earthy and challenging just to like make it day to day in some of these countries,
but
not so much Japan.
Traditions can carry them through.
Yeah, there's a great faith in the tradition.
Yeah, a great faith in the traditions.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I first came to Zen, it was having had this experience with images of monks in Dasahara, and I knew that. Something inside me knew that. And so when I first came to it, it was like trying to match, you know, what is this? And then I encountered Joe Dogen, and he did me in.
He did?
He did me in.
Oh, he did you in, yeah.
Yeah, I couldn't get it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so then I started taking Tibetan teachings, which were more available,
mm-hmm.
you know, they fleshed out,
yeah,
the spiritual path, the spiritual experience, the human experience more.
Yeah, and they're not trying to intentionally hide the Dharma in obscure poetry,
yeah.
And all, yeah. Which is part of the Zen style.
Right in the middle of all the
yeah, yeah.
Experience.
So therefore, in American Zen, or at least San Francisco Zen Center experience, seems like a lot of the both Theravada and Tibetan teachings are brought in to mix with the classic Zen,
mm-hmm.
which in a way that wouldn't be the case in Japan.
Yeah, it seems to me that there's going to be like more steps.
Yeah.
Before you get to
yeah,
what could be just really intellectual. I mean, there is that quality to it, the ultimate. And it's not that people don't want to get there, but they just need to go through more unpeeling.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
At least I did.
Mm-hmm.
Now when I come back to practicing Zen again, I mean, but sitting was always my foundation, even through the Tibetan practices. And not that I accomplished them, but I had a thorough exposure to them and many wonderful teachers.
Yeah.
Now I have that experience to bring. And it's not that I'm not stymied, but I don't worry about it.
Yeah. Yeah. And you've been practicing a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, these are questions and things to think about. Yes?
Well, I'm just thinking what Corey was saying about Pema, and of course, I've only heard stories about, you know, Koban and Suzuki and Katagiri as being very compassionate too. And maybe that's, you know, somehow they were able to meet us Americans. And maybe that was their kind of karmic disposition as well. D.T. Suzuki came 50 years before, but he was more of an educator, more of a scholar, and Suzuki, you know, and the hippies on Haight Street seemed to really have a good match, and people that I know that are Colvin students, I think they were a good match. You know, they had that hippie element in the early days, I think. And Colvin was always described as being very warm. So I think you look at Zen My Beginner's Mind, and it's different than Dogen, although I think Suzuki was steeped in Dogen. It is an interesting question you brought up. Akiba is building a Zen training monastery in Lake County so that American monks have the opportunity of Japanese training.
I think of this kind of thing too, especially during Sesshin, because Sesshin seems like intensive meditation retreats were designed maybe this is my like biased and misinformed understanding, but I have thought of them myself as that's the enlightenment soup pot. Is Sesshin. It's like maybe people that don't necessarily come to Sesshin to kind of like get in touch with their emotions, but maybe in American Sesshin or modern times, maybe it is somewhat that way. But is it good for that actually, or not? And Sesshin creating this space to just be with our experience versus a way to kind of hone our prajna in this new way. Almost maybe different intentions behind Sesshin. We say in the Sesshin guidelines, it's kind of nice because maybe it covers all of them. When we say Sesshin is a time to clarify, deepen, and actualize, to discover anew, clarify, and actualize our deepest intention. So our everyone's deepest intention might be slightly different, and this all this silent time can be a good way to rediscover our deepest intention, or maybe it's a new one every session, and clarify it and actualize it, let it come to fruition. Yeah.
Believe that one could could get what they really needed from a sashin here, it had to be a tasahara. Because there it was in a context, and there you could be, that could just be an expression of what you were already in a sense doing all the time. And there it fit into a way of life. Even if it was a 3 month period, or if you stayed for a year, or you stayed for what, 10 years or something. And my sense was, well, let's see, if I'm going to make this work, I'm probably going to have to have my life, try and do the things I want to do, but I'm going to need to regularly go back and have a practice period, let's say a minimum of every 2 years. And that'll be my, like, refresher. And then I'll try and bring out whatever that brings, and I'll try and live as much as I can, but probably by the time 2 years is up, it'll be just gone. You know, I'll be watching TV and eating crap, junk food, and whatever. So I go back for another, at least a practice period, maybe. That was my idea, you know, and you know, I want to be very careful not to disparage what we do. I'm going to do it. I'll do it for the rest of my life here, as far as I'm concerned. But I just do see it as extremely challenging and very difficult. You know, the sashins here are totally different from me than they ever were at Tassahara. You know? And it doesn't mean they're worthless. Doesn't mean it just means to me I see it's really difficult. Living in this life, living in this, going right back out into that pace, having 1 week, you know. I mean, even like the Sufi retreats were 2 weeks, no talking at all, you know, and a lot of meditating. And there, see, when I was younger too, though, so that made a difference. I could do it. But I did feel transformed coming out of those because it felt like after not saying a word for 2 weeks, it was like there was so much energy, and you were so clear on how much leakage, you know, there was in all this talking and this.
How did people get away for 2 weeks?
It was mostly young people. Mm-hmm. It's the same here, you know, people can't do it. They didn't have to be a particular group, you know. It was mostly young people.
Younger retired.
And the retired weren't even there. It was mostly young people. Or there were a few, yeah.
Yeah, these are big questions, right? For little bitty baby Buddhism coming to the land of the barbarian, right? How do we're just taking our first little baby steps?
Nothing
supports it. I mean that's looking at one side of things. The other side of things is that it is being supported enough that here we are in Sashin, right?
Well, we make it on a little effort.
Here we are.
But the world isn't helping us. I mean, not in my mind.
Mm. Yes, Andrew.
Yeah, it occurred to me, you were asking back and forth, how does one get away, right? And, you know, it seems, coming from a massage background, personally, massage therapy originated in the temples, and it was a very, very sacred relationship. You would have practitioner and recipient, and now they have like massage teams at Google, and major corporations have, you know, whole departments where it's almost, you can be a corporate shaman nowadays, where each individual organization is almost like a village, and each village has like a healer, let's say. And wouldn't that be a cool thing if you didn't have to get away? If you had like a sashin container within, you know, one of these organizations, where it's like once a quarter, you know, there was like a company mandated sashin time. We did 3 to 5 days or whatever it was on the premises in a container there. You didn't have to go anywhere. You get paid to like go into sashin.
But there is types of mindfulness training being offered at corporations.
Too true, yeah.
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 They're moving like that.
They are, yeah. It's like the cream, you know, maybe their attitude, I don't know if they're, it's like this cream, these perks, you know. Well, look out. You don't know what you're getting into. Hopefully.
Yeah, integration. How do we do this integration?
Yeah.
This ongoing study we should keep alive.
And nonviolent kinds of trainings, too.
Yeah. Yep.
Right.
Yep, because the mindfulness movement doesn't have the ethical part built into it, except for the fact that if we're more mindful, we're naturally more ethical. But it's not explicit. I would say that might be the main difference between Buddhism and mindfulness-based stress reduction, is it's just about stress reduction and not about how then, when you're less stressful, then how do you relate to others in the world.
But the nonviolent communication is a
lot. Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, back to Kazan and his monastery with all these crazies into this crazy talk, where Kazan says, "Good people, do not get caught up even in nothingness." That's a good example, right? Like, most people are like coming in with their I'm just trying to work on this. I'm in so much pain from my relationships just breaking up and I'm getting fired and so on. We don't say, don't get caught up in nothingness. They're like, what? I'd love to be caught up in nothingness. But Kazan's talking to these people who might actually be like falling into getting caught up in nothingness. And if so, then you may become like non-Buddhists who fall into an empty nothingness. And then the translator put in, by missing one whole side of the teaching of emptiness, as a kind of little annotation. What would you say is the one side missing, one whole side of emptiness?
Compassion,
yeah. Could say compassion or form, because emptiness is form. Yeah. Do not stop in an emptiness like the empty eon before the beginning of the universe. This is like being a corpse from which the spirit has not completely departed. Do not think about putting an end to false illusions or sky flowers and trying to reach true original nature. This is like saintly people who destroy ignorance to attain the middle way. So you can see the kind of gist he's pointing at is like trying to just get away from any, like a spiritual bypass, get away from any issues. Destroy ignorance is very kind of dualistic approach to practice. Instead of an integrated approach.
Well, then that could be someone who wants to go live in a monastery.
Could be, if it's as an escape from the world.
You don't want to be in the
world. Yeah. Whereas it could be that the monastery or the retreat or the sesshin could be about integrating the world and emptiness, which we need a strong container to do that because the integration is so challenging, actually.
You mean there's somebody holding the lamp and staying in the monastery and keeping the world afloat?
Well, there's that has to happen too, but I think one could go to the monastery for some time.
That's different. Yeah.
To work on the integration.
Well, that's mine.
Yeah. Yeah, that's how I see the non-duality practice is having a lot of silent time is good, and also having some talking time is good, and having some chanting time is good, and some bowing time, and all these things. So like the no toys sesshin, I enjoy that too, but in fact I think we would really be doing a disservice to ourselves if we only had no toys sesshin, which is the, was it Uchiyama Roshi style, But then I think that they had, outside of Sesshin, they had like these Dogen seminars, and I think if we just sit without any Dharma input or other practices, we'd it maybe gets too one-sided. It's hard to do the non-dual integration of form itself is emptiness. And words and talk are themselves emptiness. If it has to be only realized in total silence, then we're in trouble, because the world is not a silent world. So if we get into this one-sidedness, like the emptiness before the beginning of the universe, then you produce clouds where there are no clouds, and produce imperfection where there is none. It will be as if you left your own home to wander in a foreign land, an impoverished guest drunk on the wine of ignorance and delusion. So again, I think this is all pointing to non-duality, which is not about stopping thoughts or feelings, but actually realizing the true nature of thoughts and feelings. That thoughts and feelings are permeated by awareness, pervaded by awareness, even made of awareness, without them stopping. Does that make sense? Non-duality. I think often beginners and advanced practitioners of Zen, still we can get into this idea of like, wouldn't it be best if we could just stop all thought and feeling? How peaceful that would be. But I think that's never the point in a non-dual tradition.
Death.
Yeah, maybe death. or these jhana states also, I think it could also be where you actually really do stop thought. But that's not non-duality. Non-duality is right in the midst of thought and feeling, and eventually in the midst of our whole crazy digital culture of busyness and speed, realizing the true nature of all that stuff. Yes.
I keep coming back, which is very helpful to me, to the teaching, isn't the ice water?
Yes. Yeah. The ice is water, and Kazan himself brings up water and waves in this very passage as it's coming in the same way. Mm-hmm. No distinction. Yeah. Kazan says, think about it. He's actually encouraging us to think instead of saying, don't think. Think about it. Actually, this translation just says, think! Exclamation point. Think. How can you think that you are somebody, or like a separate person, and speak of before your birth and after your death? Seems to me he's pointing to. How could you imagine that you are actually this separate person? You can talk about what happened before your birth and after your death as if you are this limited, like, lifespan. Is it how I hear it? What past, future, and even present can you be aware of? Was it this morning we were talking about timelessness? Yeah, I think that's the point here. Even the present, you can't really be aware of as a distinct time in this ultimate timelessness of the unborn. For vast eons, there has been no discrepancy or no difference, even for a second. We might even say no differences between anything, actually. From birth to death, it is only thus. Imo, thus. Be that as it may, if you do not intimately experience it one time, you will become deluded by your senses and their objects, and will not know this true, all-inclusive self. This is being estranged from what's right in front of you. Therefore, you will not understand the source of your body and mind, or the source of the myriad things, and you will want to brush away delusion for no good reason, and seek enlightenment for no good reason. This is maybe like we're saying the carrot of enlightenment is some kind of like state or experience that we're trying to get so that everything will be cool after that. I think this would be like seeking enlightenment for no good reason, and also just for one's own personal self. Yes.
Sorry to interrupt.
No problem.
Do you think there would be a difference between this one experience of no self and fully understanding that you haven't had the experience of no self?
That there'd be a difference between those? Because they're both experiences, you mean? We were nuancing this talk about experience earlier too, right? And saying that generally experience is something that comes and goes, that's permeated by the unborn awareness that doesn't come and go. So in that sense, any experience is not it that we're speaking of. And then if we want to shift the wording a little bit, we could say, what about like a direct taste? Or we might even, another way we might talk about it is like 100% trust. Where would 100% trust in the unborn come from, if not something like some sort of taste? And is taste not an experience? Well, this is where it gets like a fine line. But if we're saying that maybe there can be some knowing or confirmation, Dogen is very fond of the word verification or confirmation, and which is a little different than knowing or having an experience. And then if we're talking about confirmation in this way, then what would be the difference, having had the confirmation or not?
Or a direct taste of not having had this confirmation.
Oh, a direct taste of that?
Of not.
What do you mean by direct taste? Just that you know that you haven't tasted? Is there a difference? In a way, what would you say?
I think something made me ask the question.
Seems that then we have no refuge, right? We have no unshakable, reliable, total trust and refuge through birth and death, right? And if we don't have that, then I think it's not the end of suffering. Does that make sense?
It makes total sense, but I think you've convinced me of the opposite.
How so?
I think you're right. Direct taste of not knowing would be knowing.
Yeah, if it's really knowing that it's a direct taste, I think the point is that do we see this ground? Do we trust this ground that's not born and unceasing, and take refuge in it? And if that seems like an abstract or intellectual idea, that's certainly not tasting it, right? So, and then there's a difference then, even being out of touch with it temporarily is, in my experience, is, very painful. especially for like someone who's obsessed with enlightenment, it's like the ultimate pain is to be out of touch with reality. Maybe that's why those obsessed with enlightenment are like their pain around other types of emotions may not be quite as great as the pain of non-enlightenment. Which is why Dongshan said, what's the most painful thing in the entire world? And one of his students said, hell, the Avicii hell, the intermittent hell, that's the most painful. And Dongshan said, nope, that's not right. Really? Well, what do you say, Dongshan, is the most painful thing? And he said, to wear this robe and not have clarified the great matter is the most painful thing. Worse than Avicii hell. And for those, I think the robes often go with, are taken up by those obsessed with enlightenment. And so for them, this is most, most painful.
Let's take the robes off.
Or practice more diligently. More wholeheartedly. Hopefully, that's the way.
Just that, what are the stages? The stage of being unconscious and not knowing it. Then being unconscious, but actually being aware that you're not unconscious. Remember this?
And we just read that.
Yeah.
Not knowing that you're just unknowing. It came out in one of our, in the appendix, I think, that we're reading in Just Sitting. There's the highest level is practice, understanding, and realization. And then the next level is no practice, but you have understanding and you have realization. And the third level is, I won't be able to go anymore.
Is that what you were talking about, Richard?
The fourth level is none of the three.
Yeah, it's pretty much that.
I can't remember the third level.
To me, here's how I remember, is the lowest, the worst place is just the most unhappy probably, or maybe the happiest place is being unconscious and not knowing. Maybe that's bliss.
Well, ignorance is bliss, right?
Yeah, so you have that, and then you have, well, I know I'm suffering, but now I'm aware of it, you know, and that could be the step that leads you to practice. Then there's the one which is knowing your suffering, and because of that knowledge and some action on it, you start to actually be more conscious. Or you could take it to all the way to knowing and being conscious, and then the last step is not knowing and being conscious. But I have a feeling that's kind of that maybe there's a touch of that with what Rachel's saying, because the ultimate sense of I just don't know, and then making peace with that might be a cool place to be.
There's I know this is a topic for you, Richard, this not knowing thing you bring up regularly, right? Last time I thought maybe there's the not knowing that's a kind of almost like defeatist not knowing. But I think this sometimes happens in the Zen world, because we hear this teaching of not knowing is most intimate, and Bodhidharma said don't know, and that's the ultimate. And then we almost like say, well, I don't really understand what's going on, but actually that's not knowing that's the best. Whereas I think it's not the same. I think the not knowing of Zen as the, you know, enlightened not knowing is having a total trust that we cannot know things dualistically as things. We cannot know knowledge. We cannot know things conceptually.
It opens the world of magic and all possibility and miraculous being. I mean, that's one way you can take not knowing, because there is, you know, emptiness and infinite and timeless. Well, then we're living in a magical context. Or you could say that's miserable, because I can never control that. That's completely unknowable, and it's driving me crazy. Which happened to me when I was a child. I had a semi-psychiatrist. I couldn't, it was like unacceptable. I was at like 7 or something, and the idea occurred to me, there could be no, I can't understand, there has to be an end somewhere, but there is no end. And then it just started spinning around, and then I think I sort of went crazy, and then some later they said, oh, it's all fine, and I said, no, it's not. And that was it. But no, yeah, I remember, yeah, that was a pretty disturbing thing, the idea of this.
That's, I think, one of the differences between, you know, not knowing that's liberation from suffering, and the not knowing that's disturbing. That's
the thing.
You know.
So not yes. Knowing, maybe in a way, saying accepting all things without naming them, just accepting the experiences itself.
Yeah, or knowing that the names don't actually reach what they are.
Yeah, I mean,
because we're going to keep naming things.
If I have an experience and I don't try to compute it, you know, and yeah. Box it all up, then I can be informed by the experience, and I can be open to that experience.
Yeah. Or we might say, not believing that the names really do refer to the thing. Because if it was really just not naming anything, we'd become like, we wouldn't be able to talk anymore or anything, right?
Yeah, I don't mean literally, just more of a perspective of like, when situations arise, like for myself, I usually try to figure it out. I try to be rational. I try to, what can I do, what I cannot do, whatever. I try to box things up.
Yeah.
I'm open to the experience, and I respond to whatever is necessary, without, like, kind of loosely. I don't know how this kind of saying better. If I do it loosely, and I kind of respond to the need rather than what I about me, then I feel like that experience is more big. It's
a yeah.
Bigger mind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sounds right. So this, if we don't intimately taste it one time, we'll be deluded by our senses and the objects, and we'll not know this true self. This is being estranged from what's right in front of you. Therefore, you will not understand the source of your body and mind, or the source of the myriad things. And you'll want to brush away delusion for no good reason, and seek enlightenment for no good reason. What would be the source of body and mind in all things?
I was just wondering, what is he talking about?
That's what he's always talking about, right?
The source.
The source.
The unborn nature of all things.
What do you know about that?
Didn't you read that book?
The unborn nature of all things. It's the source.
I know that source.
It's the source of everything that's born, is the unborn. That's the way Gazan's talking. Also, the true self with the capital S is another name. Understand, he says here. Understand the source.
I would say accept.
Accept. Trust. How about trust? Take refuge in.
Going down that stuff.
Well, he said it in Japanese anyway. Yeah, who knows what the word was.
Right.
And this being the case, if we're missing all this, then you made the Buddha take the trouble to appear in the world? And you made the ancestral teachers courteously extend their admonitions, even though they extend their admonitions thus, you are still deluded in your own views, either saying that you don't grasp it or don't understand. Truly, you are not ignorant, nor are you actually boxed in. But you dwell vainly in thoughts and calculations, discriminating between right and wrong. So after all this, like, saying, you're so deluded, and then he's saying, but actually, you're not deluded. You're not really deluded, but because we think we are, then we get involved in all these conceptual thoughts. Don't you realize that when someone calls, you respond, and when someone points with a finger, you follow? So simple, right? Richard, yes? And like, look over there, and we look. It's the easiest thing ever, right? This does not occur through discriminating judgment or through a conscious effort. It's the working of the host.
The host.
The host. Now we're talking. This translation says, your Lord, with a capital L. But it's the same character we used in the Jewel Mirror Samadhi, the host within the host. I think a host is good. This host has neither face nor bodily characteristics. However, she never stops moving. Because of this, this mind arises as what is called body. This is what we were talking about maybe yesterday, that this unborn awareness manifests or expresses itself as a body and as a world and as emotions and so on. They're all made of the host. Yeah. So here it's called this mind with a capital M arises as what we call body. When the body appears, the four great elements, the five aggregates, the myriad pores, and the 360 bones come together and you're a body. It's like a jewel having light or sound having an echo. Can you follow this image? The unborn host of limitless, all-inclusive awareness manifests as a body in the way that a jewel manifests brightness around it, and a sound manifests an echo. The echo is, we could say, is made from the original sound, and the body is made from the original host. From birth to death, you lack nothing and have nothing in excess. With such a birth and death, though you're born, your birth has no beginning. Though you die, your death leaves no traces. It's like waves rising and falling on the ocean and leaving no traces. Even though the waves disappear, they do not go to any particular place. Because the ocean is what it is, large or small waves appear and disappear. So there's that image, right? The host is the ocean, and the body and the world and the thoughts and the emotions are like the waves that arise from the oceanic host and sink back into the oceanic host.
Well, that's space-time, according to my understanding of physics.
It seems actually that the host is timeless and spaceless.
Yeah. But still out of that.
Time and space arise from.
Space, time, and us.
Yeah, it's all coming from the inconceivable. Enough! We dedicate the merit of our patience with the unborn to the well-being of all beings. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. and delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it.